The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, great. It's TK and Christian.
Oh, you're together. Wonderful. Okay. Wonderful. Glad to have you all on. So we have voices and not video. Not sure why, but that's how we're going to do it today. Yeah, we're not going to have video today. So bear with us, but welcome. Apologies for getting our technology up and running a few minutes late. We have. I'm going to do a quick round of introductions, starting with the folks we have here in the room, and then those of you on the call. So I'm speaking Susanna Sakwoto from the War Crimes Research Office, and Patty Gossman, who's in Europe right now and is joining us via Skype. We're the two who convened this in the previous meeting. We're joined here by Roya. Maybe would you introduce yourself and just the name of your organization?
Roya Boromont. I am the director of the Boromont Foundation, Abdulrahman Boromont Foundation, and we work on human rights and democracy in Iran, documenting executions mainly.
And then to my right, John, who will introduce himself, but who wasn't with us last time and is with us now. We're looking forward to his contributions.
Okay. Hi, Patty, TK, and Christian. This is John Torchari. I'm at the University of Michigan, and I'm also a legal advisor at the Documentation Center of Cambodia, which, as you know, works on sort of memory and justice issues with respect to the Khmer Rouge atrocities in Cambodia.
Hi.
Patty, you want to say a word?
Yeah. So I've been working on documentation issues, everything from trying to see how we can support prosecutions or other sort of that kind of accountability sort of proceeding, and then from memory and the whole range of TJ sort of applications in Afghanistan. I've been sort of involved in that work for the last couple of decades. So I'm particularly interested to talk about in situations where, like many of us face, where there aren't those obvious sort of prosecutorial sort of possibilities, how to get people in the country sort of to, you know, interested in this kind of documentation, or beyond interested, but to see the need, the necessity, the value in this kind of archiving and possibilities for sharing.
Thanks, Patty. So we'll get to the sort of, you know, our two kind of agenda items in a moment, but wanted to give TK and Christian a chance to introduce themselves as well.
Yeah, so I'll start this. My name's Christian Kelleher. I'm the project manager for the Human Rights Documentation Initiative here at the University of Texas at Austin, and we work with a number of different project partners and have various kinds of strategies to try to support their documentation and their use of their collection and use and preservation of documentation. And really, we take a supporting role, or try to take as much of a supporting role as we can, to meet the goals of those partners that we have. And right now, our biggest partner is the Kigali Genocide Memorial Center in Rwanda. And they have collecting our documentation from the genocide. And we have a good project in Southeast Asia collecting some, it's doing some documentation from Burma, Myanmar. And we do some work in Guatemala too. We've done a great, really exciting project with the Guatemala National Police Archive there.
Yeah, this is TK Sainwan. I'm the human rights archivist for the Human Rights Documentation Initiative here at the University of Texas Libraries. And Christian did a great job of summing up really the philosophy that underlies our work in these archival partnerships. And in addition to the organizations that he mentioned, we also have projects in Latin America and El Salvador with the Museum of the Word and Image. We're also working with a nonprofit organization in New York called Witness. They work with a lot of these smaller NGOs, and we are their institutional archive for all the footage that they gather through their own partnerships. So those are the different types of organizations that we work with.
So thank you. I think it's so fascinating to me. We have a wealth of experiences here in the room, and it sounds like we have similar goals, but we all have slightly different projects. And I think all of the regions in which we work are at different phases of sort of during conflict and post-conflict situations. Our one partner who was here last time, who isn't with us today because they are preparing for a big conference on Thursday, is the Syrian Justice and Accountability Center. I have shared with the folks here in the room a printout of the latest blogging about documentation and accountability and transitional justice issues that they have up on their site, and I'm certainly happy to share that with you, TK, and Christian, and Patty, after this meeting. But I think what we wanted to do, we had a really nice, fruitful discussion last time, and it was mostly, I think, introduction about what we do, how we do it, what our goals are, and sort of just learning about each other. I think from that conversation, there was enough sort of commonality, again, of goals and of what we're trying to do, whether it was sort of memorialization, the virtual memorial for victims that Roya's group does, certainly establishing a historical record holds true for all of us, and then sort of teeing up for or assisting in accountability mechanisms and transitional justice processes. But we all go about it a slightly different way, and so what came out of that meeting that I think we were sort of hungry to continue the discussion for was overcoming challenges. I think both technical, we in the email talked about technical challenges, and maybe we can focus on that, although we don't have our technical folks here today, but also personal in the sense of how do you create incentives for people who have experienced the atrocities to interact with the collection, the documentation collection. On the one hand, there's that sort of incentives and then security issues and other challenges. And then the other one that Patty mentioned a few moments ago is the exploration of short-term transitional justice options where immediate transitional justice options are foreclosed. And a few ideas that I just want to throw out there and then, you know, just throw open the discussion is the one I mentioned, SJAC blogging about transitional justice and what's coming out of their documentation effort seems to be one possible short-term option. Training education efforts, SJAC, again, is a good example of this. They just did a 3-day workshop on documenting torture cases with local groups. There's another group called Avocats Sans Frontières, who is doing training for NGO groups that are interested in supporting, in this case, the work of the ICC, but it could be other transitional justice options in sort of in gathering evidence. What's the best practices of gathering evidence if you want to share that in a useful way with international tribunals or other mechanisms? And then the third sort of short-term transitional justice option is sort of raising transitional justice in the national debate. And, you know, whether reporting from or issuing reports and publicizing reports that come out of the database, the documentation project, is one way to trigger that national debate. So I throw that out there as sort of the beginning of our conversation. And I might suggest that we start there rather than the technical challenges, seeing as we don't have the SJAC technical assistance person here, and certainly we don't have our own. So, Patty, I don't know if you want to add anything to that introduction.
Yeah, let me just say a little bit from our experience, because Afghanistan, we are, not unlike some other countries, but just to sort of note some of the particular constraints that we've been operating under. There was a lot of hope at the beginning of the, you know, post-2001 period that there might be an opening enough to begin to address some of the pressing sort of issues of how do you deal with the legacy of war crimes from the past. And maybe we hoped too much, but all that now seems, it's very hard to get traction on any of the possibilities for addressing the past. So we never even thought prosecutions was very likely, but now it seems to be even talking about this has become so controversial and dangerous that it's hard now, I think, for many of the groups who I've been at this for a while, and we had worked with in this particular project that we're engaged in now, began, about 4 years ago. And even then there was some, sense that we could get a little further than we have gotten. And so it's a bit hard to come back to people and persuade or get the sense that they see that there's going to be some point, in a sense, in establishing or building and adding to this archive. And I don't know, I'm sure other people have gone through these kind of dark periods, but even though there is, everybody will tell yes, it's very important, but there's a great, also because we're coming up to a point where everybody thinks there may be a return to war next year when the international forces withdraw. So it's very dark right now, and it's kind of hard to see how we don't want to be doing this all from our. We really want this to be an Afghan, creation, body of information. But I find that that's become very difficult lately when people feel there isn't really clear how this is going to contribute to anything in the future.
Well, on that very depressing note, thank you, Patty. Now, one thing that occurs to me, on that note, is Cambodia. I mean,
yes.
there were dark ages or dark moments, very dark moments in Cambodia while even after the setup of the Documentation Center at Yale. And so maybe, I don't know how much you were a part of it in those days, but through those dark periods, before there was even a reconvening or a re-energizing of the negotiations for the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, in those days where it was very confusing and dark with respect to transitional justice options, what was the sort of approach of the Documentation Center, and were there any short-term efforts made that then you saw bear fruit, years down the line?
Yeah, so the timeline that you referred to is, this is John speaking, the timeline that Susanna is referring to is that the U.S. Congress passed a Cambodian Genocide Justice Act in 1994. The Documentation Center was created as a field office of Yale's Cambodian Genocide Program in 1995. And had a two-year window of funds channeled through the State Department, and then in 1997 became an independent NGO. Now, in 1994-95, there were only sort of the idea or the twinkle in somebody's eye of the future of criminal trials against the Khmer Rouge. And at that point, so during that initial period, we were in something akin to the world that Susanna and Patty are describing, mm-hmm. still very dicey politically to deal publicly about the Khmer Rouge crimes, and no trials on the horizon. And so in that period, the center focused on a couple of things. One was simply taking what information was available, often in warehouses or in government files that had been neglected for 10 or 12 years, and organizing them technically into a functional archive, but not really disseminating them very much in that early period. Mm-hmm. More of the focus was on sort of creating the foundation for later being able to disseminate them. And secondly, insofar as there were activities that were related to this sort of accountability process, it was almost all training. And you just mentioned that SJAC is working on some training initiatives. So I think that the people, and I wasn't involved until a few years later, but I am familiar with the history of the mid-90s. mainly it was sort of prep work. And I think the prep work was possible because there was enough sort of political buy-in, not a lot, but enough in Cambodia to allow it to take place relatively securely. And very importantly, there was somebody outside the country who was funding it. In this case, it was almost all U.S. money.
Right. And it was located at UFO at that time.
Yeah, the
documentation. Collection.
The collection was, so copies of it was copies of it were made and then sent overseas. I mean, basically it was the sort of a generation less sort of advanced than what our friends from UT are doing with the Guatemalan Police Archives. So we didn't have the ability to do PDF files and put them online in the late 1990s, but microfilm was the next best thing at that time. So it was a similar strategy insofar as trying to create insurance against the political risk that conditions would change in Cambodia or that Khmer Rouge sympathizers would come burn down the building. Using that initial period to basically secure the information before it was possible to widely disseminate it. Right. Then in the late 1990s, the negotiations for the tribunal started. This is when I got involved, around 1998, 1999. We were all enthusiastic about preparing for that process, and so my initial role and a few other people was to go through all of these files, not to publish anything, but privately to create sort of blueprints of what was available so that truth seekers, be they commissioners of a truth commission or prosecutors or so forth, would be able to hit the ground running. So again, it was still in the nature of preparation, but now with a more concrete target in sight of a tribunal. As Susanna alluded to, the negotiations fell off the rails in 2000-2001 because the UN and the Cambodian government were at loggerheads. And so then the center had another of these moments where it was operating in the absence of any sort of identifiable target for the deployment of the information, any formal accountability process. And what DCCAM did during that period was to focus on not so many materials that were directly pertinent to accountability or trying to share publicly information about the liability of particular individuals for crimes, but to tell histories of particular aspects of the regime and to publish a magazine and disseminate around the country that really at that time was mostly about the sort of experiences that typical survivors had endured during the Khmer Rouge period, to try to build sort of a broad public constituency for the center's work. And so, again, with foreign funding, mostly U.S., but also now Canadian, Swedish, Norwegian, so on, the center was able to hand out somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 copies a month for free of this magazine. Often it was village chiefs in the villages around the country would sit on their steps of their sort of stilted houses that are typical in the countryside there and read articles aloud to people from the village, most of whom were either children or elderly or semi-literate. And that was how the center got the message out and tried to build support for its work at the sort of grassroots. And of course, on the other end, eventually, in 2003, the negotiations got back on track with the tribunal, so there became more sort of high-level support for explicitly sort of accountability-oriented use of the collection. But that's a sort of maybe long-winded but response to something.
No, very, very helpful.
Very helpful.
Just a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that what you did between 2001 and 2003 had anything to do, did it influence negotiations in any way? The fact that these stories are getting out to people across the country or, you know, out publicly, the history of event is getting known.
I think so. In the early period of negotiations in about 2000, the disagreement between the United Nations Secretariat, or the Office of Legal Affairs, and the Cambodian government was who would have preponderant control of a tribunal. The Cambodians wanted it to be majority domestic, the UN wanted it to be like Sierra Leone, a majority international, and eventually in late 2002, it was a bunch of members of the powerful UN member states who pushed through a resolution through the General Assembly that basically forced the Secretariat to go back and sign a deal. And so the question is, did the did the sort of availability of this information and the existence of the archive help to incentivize states to push through the tribunal, for better or worse, in terms of the form of the tribunal? I think probably yes. I can say for certain that many of them cited it. So when we talked to the member state representatives, they said, well, look, there's all this information available, and we've got these books of the history. The public is eagerly receiving this information, and so it contributes to the push for a tribunal process. How important a factor is, it's harder to tell. But I can say that we heard a lot of donors in that period saying that it contributed to the impetus. And certainly we can say that once the political sort of stars aligned to have the process, the existence of the archive made all the difference in terms of being able to mount a prosecution. For all of its problems, it has many problems, that the Khmer Rouge Tribunal has at least had at its foundation a wide body of information to draw from.
Right. So I have a couple of other follow-up questions. This is fascinating history. On the early days, again, sort of going back to the dark period, when you looked at, kind of collecting the reports and the information that was out there, where did those come from and how did you organize them in the beginning? And then you said the focus was that in training. Who did you train, diaspora or Cambodian? Where did you do the training? How did you get people to come to your training? I wanted to drill down a little bit on the, and again, this is predates your time there, but to the extent you know this history, that's really kind of where we are. So I want to unpack that a little bit.
Sure. So there are lots of different collections of documents, but the sort of cornerstone of the collection is a collection of documents, or two collections of documents, that were left behind by the Khmer Rouge regime when they fled and the Vietnamese invaded, and that were then locked up and basically left to rot in, again, I'll refer to the Guatemalan police archives that Christian and TK have worked with, very similar, giant rooms, not nearly as large as the AHPN collection, but collections of documents in piles, kind of disorganized, a little moldy, but from what we can tell, untouched during the period when they were locked up. That was given by members of the ruling party, of the Cambodia's People's Party, to the Documentation Center, and I don't know... I've asked, but I'm not sure that I've gotten all of the details of what informal sort of agreements were made when those documents were handed over. I suspect that there was an understanding that the documents would not be immediately sort of made public in their entirety. I also suspect that whether it was spoken or unspoken, that there was a very strong presumption on the part of the officials who gave over the documents that they weren't to be used to target sitting officials, which is a third rail issue in this whole process in Cambodia, because some of the Khmer Rouge mid-level commanders are now in high-level positions in government. So I suspect that there were some semi-spoken or unspoken understandings with that regard, but otherwise the documents were handed over, and the Ministry of Interior, which had physical control over them, and then later on the Ministry of I think it's the Ministry of Culture that's in charge of libraries and archives there, gave an informal permission to DCCAM to have custody over them and organize them. And in Cambodia, these things tend to be done by letters that don't say very much to preserve executive discretion to unwind deals at their convenience. Right. And that's what DCCAM got, a letter saying that the Prime Minister supports your use of these documents to promote memory and justice in Cambodia, and didn't say much more than that about the terms of the deal. The Documentation Center also got a lot of information through survivors handing over diaries and notebooks and things of that nature. And in general, that followed periods of kind of courtship by the center's director and staff, who would get to know people and say, look, you can trust us with this information. This information isn't going to be handed over to anybody who's going to harm you. We'll tell you exactly what we plan to do with it, and we plan to make it part of this archive. It'll be available under a set of procedures to scholars, but you know, if they make reference to you, then they'll have to get in touch with you for your consent and so forth. And so they were able to pick up, this is all before I arrived, the center was able to pick up a lot of these materials from people who probably were happy not to have it found on them, but who wanted to be part of the historical record. And then in the next phase, in the sort of 2000-ish phase, the Documentation Center went out and started doing large numbers of interviews of survivors for its history period. This was another really high-risk period. I remember going on these myself, interviewing former Khmer Rouge cadres, and we had big debates. Should we bring armed guards? Should we not bring armed guards? Should we arm ourselves? Should we not arm ourselves? What should we tell people we're interviewing about the use of this information? And we had to have a long kind of conversation involving our legal counsel about what we would say the disposition of the transcripts would be. But to our surprise, and it really was a surprise, we didn't have any big security incidents. That might not be true in other countries, obviously. It's a high risk. But the center was able to start accumulating a large number of these transcripts of interviewees. And some of them would then say, well, as a matter of fact, I also have this notebook, or I also have these old Khmer Rouge newspapers that have been sitting underneath my, you know, my desk for all these years. And so the center continued to pick up small new collections that way. Susanna asked about what training accompanied all this sort of historical effort. The trainings were initially run in Cambodia by people from Yale Law School, and the topic of the trainings were things like basic training about defense rights, basic training about human rights, and they had an explicit nexus to the Khmer Rouge accountability process, but they weren't, and they involved local civil society types and local government lawyers and in a couple of cases, local journalists who just wanted to learn more about the law. But they had the approval of the relevant ministers in the government as just a normal capacity building exercise, and fortunately in the Cambodian context, you could say that it had a relationship to the Khmer Rouge accountability process without that being a deal killer for a training. Obviously, in other contexts, that may not be possible. But I think what we were aiming for. What they were aiming for, my colleagues before I started, and then when I've done training since, what we've always been aiming for is to use this accountability process really more as a vehicle for imparting more general skills about advocacy and human rights than anything else. And so if we were to sever the training entirely from the word Khmer or the words Khmer Rouge, mm-hmm. by my thinking, that would have been just fine. The principles we were trying to impart didn't need to exist only in the Khmer Rouge context, for sure. Mm-hmm.
TK and Christian, I wanted to give you an opportunity to pipe in here, whether you have questions or thoughts on what we've been discussing so far.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that the history and to see both the ways that it's similar to and different from each of our partners, and to kind of recognize that all of our partners have different experiences. And I think that our focus seems to be a lot more on the documentation side rather than on the sort of the human rights advocacy. You know, that's something that our partners do, and we kind of don't direct their work at all on both a, you know, philosophical and practical purposes. We want them to be the ones who are giving direction to the advocacy work that's happening and the appropriate form of that. But also, we just don't have the resources to be the driving force behind it. So in training, for example, the training does tend to be technical. How to preserve documentation, how to do metadata and make sure that the documentation that is collected is collected in a way that means that it'll be useful in the future. And then the partners themselves, they're the ones who make the choices of how it's done and go out and actually do the documentation. So, and they're so different. So for example, in Rwanda, our partner, the Kigali Genocide Memorial Center, is very much a memorial collection, recording materials from the genocide, recording testimonies from the genocide, and that includes survivors and perpetrators and bystanders, and their goal really is memorial, not so much justice.
Right.
You know, that's something that the ICTR has taken on, and that the Gacaca courts in Rwanda have taken on. So then our role is to support preserving that documentation and making sure that it's in a form that's useful. So we are helping them to become really authorities in archiving in the country, and they're working with the president's office. They're working with the Gacaca courts. And there's a long-term goal to try to get some sort of control back over the ICTR materials, to say that that's Rwandan material that really should be part of the Rwandan patrimony. But then in our partner in Southeast Asia, they do humanitarian aid, and documentation is a part of their ongoing activities. So, you know, we've helped to do training to preserve that material. We provide a service of a digital preservation for that material, but have stayed out of, you know, trying to impact their ongoing daily activities for humanitarian goals. So we are a little bit different, I think, than what I've heard from and seen about other organizations. I don't know, TK, if you have.
Yeah, I would agree that most of the partners that we work with aren't exactly in working on transitional justice efforts directly, with the exception of Free Burma Rangers. I think they do hope that their documentation can be used in future accountability efforts against the state, but the rest of the organizations that we work with really have more of an educational mission, that is, that their documentation will be used, in the classroom or to teach future generations about these human rights violations that have occurred. And so in that sense, their work is a little bit different, and so we haven't been working directly with transitional justice efforts.
And then with some kind of exception for the Guatemalan National Police Archive, where they do have a goal of using the documentation there, and they have done to prosecute violations, human rights violations. But it is it's also a much broader aspect of that, and that's not, you know, our role. Again, that's being directed by the National Police Archive and by the, well, I don't know who exactly these days is directing those efforts. But it's, again, so our piece of it is supporting and preserving the documentation and providing just some kind of technical guidance.
Right. Well, yes, because we kind of are not in the place that you all are, because we can't really go around in Iran and ask people. Although, you know, there are people who do that or used to do that until a few years ago. So it's not even. It's not always the same. But certainly. being here, getting a little bit of national endowment funding has made collaboration with us a crime. So we are in a very different place in terms of our activities with regard to Iranian officials or the Iranian public. That said, we still have managed to get documents from Iran, from the web. We have combined our documentation and our human rights education because we, you know, witnessing Iranian history, we think that, you know, people need to be aware of their rights in order to either prevent abuses from happening or at least, you know, letting their interlocutors and their interrogators or officials know that they know what is wrong, which was not necessarily the case 30 years ago. And so, you know, with the presentation of the cases online include the human rights violations right there. And then the presentation of the cases are all due process. And the forms that we have online that people send to us are all due process. So, and we also train when we see survivors who are more into collecting documents, work of memory, and who are active, then we engage with them and we try to train them into how to interview and how to, you know, to ask questions and how to keep records. And some of them continue to do it and send us information. So even though they are not dealing with us, every now and then we get a bunch of things because they've met people who have come from Iran and here is what they have. But people from Iran send us documents. They send us court documents. They send us, you know, letters from prison. They send us whatever they have. And, you know, interestingly enough, the courts don't give their sentences anymore. They allow the lawyers to see it. But they don't allow photocopies and they don't allow. And so, you know, unless it is in a remote place or some non-important figures, then we may get something. But they are very aware of what these things can be used for. You know, how to engage them, because I think that was a little bit the question. Is, you know, I think the fact that it's online and then people can see that actually the world can see what happened to them has been an incentive. You know, getting the radios and televisions transmitting into the country to talk about us, or which hasn't been easy actually, and that inside the country they are more interested in what we do than outside the country. But that has been helpful. Each time we've been on one of these outlets, we have like a bunch of information coming our way from Iran.
Right.
But, you know, we having particular events documented by non-Iranians, like, you know, this prison massacre in 1988, where at least 4,000 people who had been previously sentenced were hanged secretly in a couple of months, interviewed by a committee, and if they were not repenting from their views, then they were hanged. And that had never been recognized. Families had been informed after the fact, not knowing where their loved ones were buried, and prevented from mourning, like no ceremonies, no. And so, until a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, there was no talking about it. The officials did not really acknowledge. And then, you know, we had a report done by
Jeffrey Nice.
Jeffrey, yes, by an international human rights lawyer. And then we had a symposium inviting people who had worked on different countries with different expertise. And that created, you know, a buzz. And then we had the prime minister of the time coming out and saying no one can say that the government knew what was happening, or if it knew, it could have prevented it. And then, you know, you had...
So the prime minister responded.
Yeah, of the time. But he's now you know, not in power anymore. But then, you know, there was another event that had even more impact on engaging survivors, which was a televised tribunal, right? And we provided them with our cases because we have more cases than anybody else. We started in 2002, so we have a lot. We have collected a lot. We have interviewed a lot of people. And so we gave them, but we didn't participate because we felt that it was a political, very politicized event, that it was focused on a period where a category of people had been killed, mm-hmm. and that they didn't want actually to document what had happened to other people. So,
and who organized?
It's a human rights, well, it's a number of people. Uh-huh. Human rights group in Sweden, Iranian, they are Iranian. And then after the 2009 events, they got interest from other people who had not been interested. Mm-hmm. So, but that said, you know, it was on YouTube, live stream, mm-hmm. and victims from different places came and testified. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really created a discussion among all the people, a lot of people who said these are past events, you know, we don't want to go back, it's not important, and victims started to feel like maybe there is, you know, at least acknowledgement. And so, you know, on particular events, maybe it's possible to do a special event that is online or, you know, televised and has international people involved. And then, you know, at least for Iranians, having non-Iranians being interested is suddenly enough reason to come forward. And so that has proven to be successful. And then using, for example, if something happens now in an area or in terms of, you know, the punishment of an act that is a human rights violations, and then you document that, but you link it to the precedents in that same prison or with the same authorities, then suddenly it makes it more relevant to people, mm-hmm. to people who are now experiencing these.
Right, right.
I mean, the old ones are always interested because they had thought no one is gonna ever be interested in what happened 34 years ago.
Right.
But the challenge are the new, younger generations.
Yeah. So this televised tribunal, was it then based on case studies or cases that you had collected, that you had documented?
Yes, we gave them 130 of our cases that were based on interviews, not on electronic forms, because electronic forms can be anonymous.
Right.
We allow them to, so that they are not scared of sending us mm-hmm. information.
Right, right. So these were people willing to be identified.
Yes, these are not necessarily identified publicly, but the case was based on interview of immediate family or an eyewitness, or mm-hmm. but they also, because some of the people who organized were also survivors themselves, mm-hmm. and they also collected people, you know, other survivors, prison survivors, who came and testified. Not all of them, some relative, you know, some, I also know, for example, a woman who came from Kurdistan, a young lawyer who knew her uncles were executed, and she heard about the tribunal. She thought it's a real court.
Right, right.
And so she started to collect documents, which ended up having to flee because they got wind of her collecting. They are much tougher on Kurds and on, you know, people in the border areas. But she came to Turkey and she has now her documents, but she didn't go to that court because she realized that it's a symbolic. Mm-hmm. So it does engage people if they see something is happening that is with serious people, that is not about political groups trying to give visibility to their own, you know, interests. Yes. So you can engage, but it requires organizing things that are visible.
Right. Patty, I know you've been silent here for a little while. Do you want to offer any thoughts?
Sure. I think with Afghanistan, first of all, we, you know, given Afghanistan's history, we started with trying to help groups build the skills they needed to do documentation, because we started with a situation post-war where there'd been so many years of war and such a brain drain, you didn't have a large community of people who were very knowledgeable or aware of what really went into documentation, how it should be done. Really, a lot of that early work was really introducing groups to the body of information that already existed, and then talk about how groups could begin to add to that and carry out documentation. A lot of it was just training people in the essentials of doing documentation. And at the same time, there was, an effort toward advocacy. And I'd say not advocacy toward any particular goal, but really a lot of it was focused on how do we keep transitional justice keep the space open for discussing various transitional justice possibilities. And there was the kind of high point in that, I'd say, would be about 2004, when at that point the government under Karzai actually signed into law an action plan on transitional justice, which included as one of its components support for documentation, of the past. It did not include any specifics on any kind of judicial sort of mechanism, but even that has sort of off the radar entirely. I think as the counterinsurgency of the return of the Taliban is a threat, and the sort of strength in the hands of those who had fought the Taliban in the past, who were in the cabinet, who were among those who are named as war crime suspects, we found that the little foothold we had sort of begun to disappear. So there was advocacy as part of this, and training was sort of a major component of it.
Has anyone around the table engaged, and I think, Maria, you have given us some examples in the last conversation, but engaged the diaspora in this kind of advocacy about keeping accountability and transitional justice conversation going while things are so difficult inside, within the territory?
Well, we started because we, the first few years of our projects, we were not public. We didn't inform people about what we were doing because we have a large body of newspapers that are the Iranian newspapers that report executions and in the beginning report the trials. And the human rights violations in these reports are so clear. But we document every execution. It's not only political executions. But also we started to talk to close people. So what we did is that we found a number of people in the diaspora who were linked to political groups, were part of the political groups previously, and we use them as bridges because trust is very difficult to get. Why do you want this? Why do you, you're not in my group. Why are you interested? So it was a little bit hard, but with time we got more and more facility to. And then when they saw what is online and they saw what we do with the information, then we had even more. But we stay very neutral and minimalist in what we put online because, we focus on people understanding what went wrong here, what was wrong here, outside of, the fact that someone was killed in the process. But again, I still, we made public our work in 2006, and we were on Nightline and NPR and some other places, and then on some Iranian outlets. I still run into a lot of people who have no idea what we're doing. And so that means that, the exile community, because the stakes are not as high, they are not as closely. They are interested, they would like to help, but it's not their major. Mm-hmm. And because the non-repetition for them is not as much of an issue because they are here and they live in a safe. And so it hasn't been easy, but it is really possible. And I think, you know, the one thing that we have been always thinking about, if we had the resources, is to hire Iranian Americans, younger people who have grown up here, and Iranian Canadians, Iranian French, and they don't necessarily read Farsi, but just through them to try to get the parents and their relatives, and then, you know, start the movement like that. And so that also, you know, once we catch one person, then it kind of
ripples.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it requires us to be more out and not buried under our documents. And because we, you know, we don't get the kind of funding that allows us to have, you know, 25 people working on all of this case so that we could go out and reach out. It's not as fast, it's not as effective as it could be, but it can be very effective.
Right. I don't know if you had thoughts on what we just covered, or sort of diaspora, lessons learned from working with folks outside. But it sounds like most of your work was focused inside. The training was done there, but with the help from Yale. But was there any effort to reach more broadly the diaspora in the work?
We have, in the Cambodian case, we've had oral history sessions with Cambodians living overseas. Mm-hmm. We've had outreach in those communities to share some of what the center has produced and to get their own testimonies and interview people in Long Beach, California, and Lowell, Massachusetts, where there are big Cambodian diasporic communities, and in France. But it does link to something that I thought a number of people have brought up that was important. And you mentioned, Roy, about the importance of being seen as serious and non-political. Mm-hmm. You're documenting human rights abuses, so you're normatively committed to upholding human rights, but you're not grinding in particular political acts. The challenge with the diaspora in the Cambodian case is that the Cambodian diaspora is, I think, both in actuality and in perception, linked very strongly to a particular side of the political spectrum. So and I think that this would be true in a lot of countries that we're talking about. So the Cambodian diaspora is overwhelmingly very sternly opposed to the government that's in power. And so we thought about doing a bunch of events to use the diaspora, but we were afraid that it would jeopardize something that was even more important to us, which was the in-country perception that this was a relatively fair exercise, fair in the political sense of the term. And that made it possible to go out and interview all these people in the countryside. Mm-hmm. If at any point, we already had Western funding, which for the Cambodian government would make us, you know, would raise some eyebrows. We had Western advisors. Mm-hmm. We're talking about human rights. And so we've made a real effort. The director, I think, has done this quite well, of presenting the center as one that has international support but is not linked in any way for or against a particular party in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's helped calm enough nerves to help facilitate some added access. Another comment that I had, based on some of the other comments, is along similar lines, is sort of how do you get around the elephant in the room, which is the political will problem in most of the countries we're discussing. Cambodia is an easier case in that respect than the others that you all are mentioning. And one way is, of course, to try to appear fair so it doesn't look like it's a smear campaign against any one party, especially the incumbents who are best positioned to stop the effort. And then secondly, it's this focusing on technical capacity. I myself am a big fan of this, so everybody basically has mentioned that their groups do some sort of technical training that isn't explicitly linked to mm-hmm. a sort of transitional justice. And probably that's as productive a way as any to put the pieces in place so that when political conditions are right, mm-hmm. the opportunity can be seized. So mm-hmm. I love the idea of training people who are archivists in societies that don't have any archivists, and training defense lawyers in places where a generation has been wiped out by civil war and so forth. I think that a big part of this question that we're talking about today of how you do transitional justice in places where there's no political will has got to be sort of through these indirect mechanisms of setting up capacity so that when a window opens, there are people with locally in a position to capitalize.
So that sort of takes us back to our Texas colleagues. I wonder if you could, I know the organizations you work with, again, are all in slightly different, have emerged in slightly different contexts, but to the extent that you do what John just said, sort of capacity build on the technical side of documentation, are there any lessons learned there that you could share with us in terms of how the how-to, do you go in-country? Do you have people come to you? Do you convene in sort of a conference setting? You know, how do you capacity build on documentation?
Typically, our model has been for us to go to them. I think this works because, one, we get to have a better idea of what type of resources they're working with, what their reality is, because they can come here and see what we do here at UT, but obviously, we have very different types of resources available in these different settings. Also, going to the organization and where they're based also promotes the sense of ownership that they have over their own materials that they're archiving. So the way it's typically worked is, in the case of El Salvador, we're working with them to digitize their collection of radio recordings from the Civil War. And the director of the museum is actually one of the main journalists from the guerrilla radio station. So what we did was bring down the equipment necessary to digitize the materials on site. And they're already doing different types of digitization with their film. So there was already that basic capacity there. And then what they're doing right now is digitizing their cassette tapes and then sending the digital files back to UT, where we're preserving that digital copy. And they maintain custody over the original materials as well as their own digital copies. And this is basically the model that we use with our partners in Kigali, Rwanda, where they maintain physical custody over all the videotapes that they have, and then they send us digital copies should anything, befall the originals. And so, once again, the idea is that we help build capacity and promote, their ownership over their own materials so they can do with them what they see as the most pressing and necessary within the context that they're working in.
And I think we've seen that as John, I think, was alluding to, that it has repercussions outside of the organizations. So like in Rwanda in particular, the Kigali Genocide Memorial has really become the place where if people have archives questions or want someone to look at their historical records, those are the people to go to, and even to the extent that the president has done so, and I mentioned the Gachacha courts, they are leveraging the capacity that has been built at the Kigali Genocide Memorial to meet their own documentation needs, and it's been done by us going there, and that really has been, like TK said, that's been the most successful element, going there and doing on-the-ground practical training. But it's also all promoted further capacity building, a broader engagement with the archival community. So in Kigali, they've had other organizations, European organizations, come down, and they've gone to visit European archives. They work very closely with the Shoah Foundation Institute out of USC, and have done a lot of trainings, both having Shoah people go to Kigali and spending some significant time in Los Angeles. So it's just, I think, instilling a recognition of the value of the archives and then trying to enable in whatever way possible them to meet the goals that result from that recognition. It's a long-term process. I think in Rwanda, what our next step would be to have real formal training. And unfortunately, that wouldn't be able to happen so well in the country, but maybe have someone who's been doing archives work for a few years now, get a degree in archival study. But in Guatemala, we've seen the same sort of thing happen. The National Police, they got training. Trudy Peterson was the archivist who really trained them on how to do the technical work on site. And then they've since become the go-to organization for a lot of archival questions and become involved with the National Archives there, the General Archive of Central America in Guatemala City. And we've been exploring ways to get formal trainings done in country. UT has a site in Antigua, Guatemala, that's a kind of a safe place. And, you know, I would love to set up an SAA training, send some SAA archivists down there and do a training in Guatemala and try to really engage professionally the burgeoning archivists in that country. It would be a great opportunity, I think.
Roy, I had a question. Perhaps for everyone involved here, is that part of what we do publicly is also meant to be a kind of warning for people who are involved in politics and may take over later, or people who are now in power, that now people are watching and that nothing goes unnoticed. But so, since you are in countries and you've worked in countries, do you have any concrete, not evidence, but at least understanding that the fact that these things are happening are kind of a little bit of a break for officials who may be tempted to get rid of their opponents, or for groups? Like, do you think that this has an impact, a deterrent effect?
In Guatemala in particular, that was actually one of the main purposes of our involvement with the police archive. They had been trained, they've been organizing the archive in country, they've been doing the digitization in country, but everything was at the police archive physically there. And recognizing the political reality of Guatemala, the goal of connecting with UT and us hosting the digital version of their archive was to sort of release some of the pressure on the archive to say, well, it's done, it's online, you know, there's nothing we can do about it now. Now it's in the United States, and I don't know how successful that is in reality, but it's got a lot of international attention, and I think it has at least raised awareness in the country and by the current political regime that there's something beyond their ability to control going on. So I think that has been really important. In Rwanda, our connection is really strongly with an organization that is very favorable to the current government. And that's limited our ability to collect in certain areas. So right now there's a lot of political pressure on the government, and they try to refocus that pressure into the 1994 genocide and away from activities that have happened since then. So in that way, you know, maybe the programs are used not necessarily in the way that we would always hope, but I think still with a positive outcome, at least to a certain degree.
I have a thought on this. I mean, this is obviously a huge question for transitional justice generally. Does it deter crimes or disincentivize crimes? There are certainly cases where the in-the-moment incentives for the leadership are such that the threat of future prosecution or the threat of having files in the archives are not a negligible, or their negligible importance in deterring crimes. But I have to think that if we imagine that there are multiple different channels through which this can work. One is the sort of the prosecution channel, where this movement towards transitional justice means they're a little more likely to be prosecuted or indicted. There's a movement toward freedom of information and so on, a little more likely that their legacy will include this ugly set of events in which they abused power. And then thirdly, the sort of short-term international media impact from things like this blog that we've been discussing from the Syrian justice folks. I would think that in sum, there those three things, or maybe there are more, probably tip the balance in at least some cases, enough to make it meaningful and worthwhile to pursue the work. I think one of the hard things about raising money for this is very difficult to prove that. Right? Very difficult to prove. But I think one way I've tried to think about it is look at the societies in which there are relatively robust domestic regimes for prosecuting malfeasance, for freedom of information, for maintenance of the official archives, and you see, I think it's fair to say that not only is it different behavior, but officials operating in those systems have a different set of incentives than the ones in domestic systems that are weak. And so what we are advocating, which is a combination of international sort of and domestic institution building or norm building, I imagine it has some impact. I think that where it has the impact is probably not on the headline crimes, like the killing of members of some sort of opposing, guerrilla force in the jungle, but it might have an impact in whether, say, the Chinese government jails some dissident artist who is known overseas and things of that nature.
I think that's it's an enormously difficult question, even for the tribunals that have concluded successfully cases, even through conviction, through appeals. The question of whether those tribunals have deterrent effect on crimes in the countries and the affected populations is also, extraordinarily difficult. Take ICTY, for example. It started in 93, and then in 98 you have the Kosovo explode. So it's, you have examples and counterexamples, I think, in each situation where, I think reasonable minds could disagree about the deterrent effect. But what's hard to show is what otherwise would have happened, more egregiously so, had there not been this intervention. So, I think that's a subject of much controversy. But I agree with John. I think at some level, it has to have some level of deterrent effect, even if it's not as wide as one might want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we had one experience in terms of that, but I'm not sure if it has to do with the fact that things are documented and kept, or the fact that everyone in the world is able to see because it's goes on YouTube, and so. But the events after the Iranian elections in 2009, at least, in a week, according to the head of the police chief, 10,000 people were arrested in a week. The same thing, the same circumstances, more or less the same subject, happened in 1981, and several thousand people were executed. This time around, not. They were beaten up and they were tortured, but they were eventually, a lot of them were let go, and their life is not going to be fun from now on. But they were not dead. And so it's hard to tell which, but obviously there is something, because the officials more or less have not changed that much. Right. The big decision makers are more or less the same, the lower levels have changed. Mm-hmm. So is this was one example, but I think we will have more impact if the media were interested in what we do. But what we do is not sexy, right? I mean, documentation is okay, they respect us, but it's not news. And so, but if they were interested in some of these And that's why that tribunal or, you know, some of these things are very impactful. Is if they get interested, then, you know, they can have some, I don't know, deterrent effect or at least some impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of points to another question, not on the original agenda, but I think that you raise the issue of evaluation or impact studies of our documentation projects. I don't know, the DC CAM being, again, the most mature of our group, if there has been any sort of formalized attempt to document the impact of the work of DC CAM on not just the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, because we know how much documentation you've shared with the tribunal over the years, but just more broadly speaking, has there been any formalized attempt to evaluate the impact of the DC CAM's work?
Individual projects, yes, not the whole thing. So every year, like all of us, we get these requests, especially from USAID, for performance evaluations. Right. And they have these little boxes and categories that need to be filled, you know, to show sort of outputs and outcomes. But the outcomes that are cited as examples are things that have so many different possible causes that it's extremely, I think, intellectually dishonest for us to claim that we are the cause. So we, like many organizations, we focus more on outputs and we use interviews with people and sort of focus groups and surveys to suggest that the activities or projects in question have had some meaning for people. But whether we're able to show that our work has contributed to more trust in the rule of law or something diffuse like that, mm-hmm. very difficult for anybody to say. I do think what is another nice thing about these technical trainings, like the ones that TK and Christian were describing in Rwanda and in El Salvador, is that I think in those types of settings where there's a relatively agreed upon standard for sort of evaluation of skill sets and of aptitudes, you could actually demonstrate through a sort of before and after that these things are actually having a payoff. Now, as Roy said, that's not the sexiest kind of payoff for donors, but maybe that's what a group like ours can help to do, is to talk to people who fund this kind of work and explain to them, look, it doesn't make headlines and it might not put as big a grin on your boss's face to hear that somebody got better at doing some sort of metadata coding, but that's actually what these societies need in order to be able to harness the potential of the information that's in there.
That's an excellent point. And it sort of gets me back to TK and Christian. You talked a little bit about, you know, the need sort of for more formal training, perhaps even, you know, another idea of bringing people from the region here for, you know, an archival studies PhD. I wonder if you have, you know, without getting too much in the weeds, some lessons learned about the sort of different levels of technical training or capacity building that you've engaged with the different groups over time, where you know, you could identify, you know, the three or four, you know, major things that you do in step one, you know, and what you say for step two and three, you know, sort of the deepening of that knowledge and what's covered at a most basic level versus later, you know, kind of what your syllabus topics would be for those basic trainings. And maybe that's, you know, highly dependent, I would guess, on the technical software that you're working with. And, you know, we talked in the first discussion a lot about using MARTIS, and we did in the beginning, we segued out of using MARTIS to another software provider because of some of the issues around distribution that we had with MARTIS. But, you know, acknowledging that there may be very different systems, are there sort of basic, areas of the agenda that you cover in level one capacity building, level two, and then, you know, PhD, bringing somebody from the region here?
Right. Well, I'd have to, I hadn't thought about it that way. What comes to mind first is actually, and I think I mentioned, just an understanding of the importance of documentation. And I think that's something that the uses of documentation that I have seen as the first necessary step to then put forth the effort to say, all right, so if the documentation is valuable for these purposes, then how do we manage it? But I think that with some of our partners, that first step of mm-hmm. instilling a recognition of the importance, just even of of creating documentation is and preserving it is important. So, like in Rwanda, there's not a strong history of documentation. There's not a record of the genocide. The by far the largest record of the genocide is the one that was created by the Getachew courts, and that was done, a decade after. So they didn't have the documents, the history of documentation that, like, Guatemala did have that came out in the police archive, or that John mentioned that there were some documentary sources that came out in Cambodia. So just recognizing that, I think, is the first step. And then getting into, getting into the technical ability. In Guatemala, I think they did a very good job of it. Trudy Peterson went in and started with ISADG, as the document that can explain how archives are built, and it works both theoretically and practically. And I think that's a really good starting point, is to base it on, I don't know, and TK may have different experience. But
just to clarify, ISADG is the international standard for archival description.
Yeah, in case you didn't. And then that really introduces the structure of archive and the idea of metadata. So I would actually put metadata elements like even digitization metadata, digital, that sort of thing, much later in the process, because you have to understand how you have to get there. So I think those would be the steps that I would undertake in such a project.
Very helpful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the another sort of high level observation in working with these different groups is that, I mean, it's been so context dependent for us, because each organization has a different set of skills and resources that they're coming into documentation with. But I think one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is that, you can't shoot for an ideal right away. When working on these documentation projects, a lot of it is learning from them what their work looks like, and then figuring out how archival principles can be incorporated into the work that they're already doing, and so that it makes sense to the work that they're already doing. Because if the training starts off with being too technical and too prescriptive, then they're not going to do it, and then there's going to be no documentation, and that doesn't serve anyone. And so really, I think it's important to learn from the organizations first about what they're doing, and then figuring out solutions that make the most sense in their own context.
Great point. Brad, did you?
Which I have forgotten. But it will come back. We had some questions we forgot. Patty, are you still with us?
Yes, absolutely. I was just waiting for an opportunity.
Please jump in.
That last point, I think, is really important, because I think some of the training work, well, I think we have made progress in Afghanistan with training people, training groups and so on to know, better how to secure their information, and really getting much further along in seeing the importance of documenting incidents and documenting them in a kind of methodologically, appropriate way, or, secure way. I think there's still, there was, and I'm part of this, coming in, often we came in with different software, different sort of ideas, and it wasn't always coming from the groups what they wanted to get done. It was sort of, look, there's this new, this software, we should all, you know, everybody got on board, we could all share. They weren't ready to share. And what maybe would have been better from the start was, as you say, to see each group and say, okay, what are you working on? How can that be, you know, what do you need to do it better? I think, at the same time, I think there's been progress made, but it's now to see, well, what do they need now further to see through the next phase, I guess. I mean, and the groups are all at different places. Some are only doing a very small thing. Some want to see, you know, the possibilities to do more. And it's an uneven pace. You have to keep up. And the other thing, just back to something that was discussed earlier, I think one area in Afghanistan that hasn't been, talking about the diaspora, there's been some efforts to explore that. And I think, unlike maybe Cambodia, it could be done in a way that wouldn't, you know, alarm people in countries, say, oh, well, this is just one-sided, because the phases of the war are such that you can do that and not do, and not be seen. There's enough flexibility there. But there just hasn't been, it's so spread out, and there has to be more resources to do that and to see how that could integrate with what's going on now. I think it's a whole area that could be worked on if there were, you know, the people and the time and the money to do it. So I mean, just sort of say that Afghanistan is sort of on some of these same, having many of these same problems. It's sort of, now we, I think, have to see how best to carry on. I mean, it's sometimes frustrating for us and for groups to say, well, okay, we know the basics of documentation, but, where's it going to lead? There's still a lot of work to be done to get people, I think, to do documentation more thoroughly and to see all the different possibilities, and to connect it with, for example, people do interviews, you know, somewhat now, but they don't see how to collect other, say, you know, report, you know, newspapers from that period, or how to integrate that, or, you know, there are still possibilities there that I think we all need to explore and work with them on.
Just one thing about this technology or helping training. When we started in 2001, I mean, we are maybe not even the typical groups that start documenting maybe in Rwanda or in Cambodia. I had worked a little bit with Human Rights Watch, and so, but we had no idea what the database is. I mean, our technological, depending on our ages, are not necessarily to the. I mean, I knew I had heard of databases, but
what is a database?
Yeah. What is exactly a database? And we got lucky because I met Patrick Ball accidentally. And he said, I'll help you. And then they came and they installed this database, which, you know, was really labor-intensive and freaked us out. But had they not done that, we would have worked for several years without an organized, codified documentation. And so sometimes being a little bit pushy is not too bad, depending on who is on the other side of your interlocutors, you know, because they may not realize how useful something can be. And if you're too respectful of their methodology, and the example would be my sister doing accounting. We couldn't afford an accountant. But after 3 years, we had an accountant, and he was stunned because she would cut invoices and staple them to paper, and everything was there. But you had to see the face of this accountant looking at this paperwork, and you know, nothing was missing, but it was not feasible.
Right.
It wasn't Microsoft money.
So that's the difference between the two you know, the two sides of the project going forward. And talking about following up on Patty, I've been thinking for a while now, and again, we don't have necessarily the resources, and it requires me to have time to look. But, you know, if we inform people we are working with of what has been done in other countries in their own language, like having little, you know, summaries of what these interviews have been able to achieve, you know, reparations here, prosecutions there, you know, memorials there, and share the experiences of some of the countries where these things have been pretty successfully, or at least, you know, relatively successfully used, then maybe the incentive, at least among, you know, some of the more active or interested groups, will make, you know, create incentive.
Well, I think just as I said, there's always a hunger for that in Afghanistan. People are always saying, well, wait, you know, they know sort of in general, but specifically, how did they get from here to there?
Yeah.
Very useful.
Is that something that DC CAM has done to share kind of, I mean, again, I look to you as the one of the more mature projects. How much has that, have you done sort of outside of Cambodia, sharing of the process and the successes and the ways you've contributed to transitional justice with others out, you know, with other folks, and certainly in our group, but have there been sort of formalized efforts in that regard?
Yes, people from the center have traveled to other places in the world, especially in the greater Middle East and region, and spoken to groups in Iraq and in other areas of the region about their experiences, and occasionally in different parts of Latin America where there are efforts underway. But not as formalized as it could be. So the International Center for Transitional Justice kind of coordinated a documentation affinity group several years ago. Louis Bickford, who was then there at ICTJ, Patrick Pierce, and a number of other people were involved. And it was with that aim in mind, and certainly not a one-way traffic. We everybody trying to learn from each other across countries, but very similar to what Roya is mentioning, and
have anything been published?
Right.
They do. They, in 2009 or 2010, the ICTJ published a document that's on their website, which I'm happy to pull up and forward around about their documentation lessons. And it was very much in the nature of trying to learn from one another.
Was that followed up by any subsequent efforts, or was it sort of ended with a report on the lessons learned?
It basically ended with the lessons learned, because that was sort of the funding cycle, and
right,
I think that was around when Louis moved to his new location with the Ford Foundation. But it was an effort not unlike what we're sort of starting here, and I think that the report, you know, drew out a number of useful kind of cross-country themes
Seems like it would be really useful.
Sure.
One thing that you touched on earlier, or maybe it was Patty talking about, the fact that local groups are at such different places, even within one region like Afghanistan. You know, we have groups at various parts of this process. And I wonder, from you, John, whether you face this sort of fragmentation in Cambodia, and how you know, how DC CAM worked with other groups contributing to documentation. What was your the kind of relationship? Was there an effort at sort of trying to coalesce the groups that were working on documentation, and how did that work? Or was it just organically, just it was going to happen at different paces with different groups, and there was no effort to kind of, you know, bring them together?
When you say different groups, you mean like former Khmer Rouge or rural, urban, or do you mean different civil society?
Different civil society NGOs also working on, projects related to memorialization or reconciliation or transitional justice, that could have dovetailed with the documentation center's work on documentation.
So I'll give a really candid answer to this. I think if you ask the other NGOs, they would say they would criticize DCCAM and say that DCCAM said this is the Khmer Rouge stuff is our turf and we're the main NGO in this area and we want control over sort of how this thing progresses. The DCCAM side of the story is, look, there were a lot of different NGOs. Some of them were strong organizations. Some were not. We picked partners where it was convenient but didn't want to set up anything too formal because some of these organizations were coming and going. Some were attacking the government in ways that would be detrimental to our efforts to be able to get secure access to the countryside. And so I think it's fair to say that other civil society groups in Cambodia, they sort of respect DCCAM's work. Most have cooperated with DCCAM from time to time, but most would have welcomed a more formal structure of like multilateral cooperation. And some have been explicit about the fact that they wanted some of the funding. DCCAM got a lot of funds. The other groups didn't get as many funds. They wanted to sort of share responsibilities and roles. DCCAM wanted to sort of keep its funding and run the show. And I imagine that that's a challenge. I mean, I was going to ask Patty about that because, Patty, you mentioned this.
Oh, yeah, I've been nodding my head while you spoke. I mean, getting hold of the funds divides the group so badly. And it's very frustrating because, in one reason, they don't want to share information because that information is their... You know, that's what they get the funding for, and they're afraid of losing their whole, you know, raison d'etre if they share. It's frustrating. And I don't know, I don't really know how to get past that. Subgroups do see, I mean, the Human Rights Commission of Afghanistan has always been, of course, a big player in this, although I think their TJ credentials have been really tarnished by the fact that they did this huge report and then don't publish it, and now the commission itself has been, you know, been stacked with a bunch of Karzai appointees. So I think the credibility of the commission is really in jeopardy now. But the groups are very divided, not only on what they do and how they do it, but because they see each other as a threat.
Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, there is always competition. And it's part of our luck is that no one is willing to go that far back. There's more competition on new
on
stuff,
the next chapter, right?
What we do, and that has I think helped our collaboration, is that, you know, when we put a story up, we put all our sources, and if one information is from one human rights group, because we collect, we can't really, we need them, especially for current events, mm-hmm. we need them because they're on site. We just put in parentheses which, where was it? So once they get visibility, and then it's in English because their stuff is not in English, right? And so they are actually happy to help, but they don't fight for funding inside Iran because that will kill them if they.
I think one thing that that makes a big difference here is, we were talking, and part of our conversation is about sort of transitional justice, and part is more about archives. And if the archive itself exists in a public body, which is the long-term optimal solution, mm-hmm. then I think the coordination problem with the NGOs becomes a little bit more manageable in the sense mm-hmm. that there's one agreed reference point. In a case like Cambodia, where it was an NGO itself that was running the archive, this is a very different dynamic, obviously. And then if there's a case where there is no central locus for archive and separate groups collecting different materials, I think then it becomes a real herding cats exercise. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear how you would coordinate that unless there were a dominant donor that was essentially dictating to the group, here's how we want you to divide up the labor.
In our case, I think we have sort of a mix, which is that we, this project started with Patty, her predecessor group, Afghanistan Justice Project, USIP, and our office, trying to kind of collect what was in basements and, you know, public source documentation on violations during the conflicts in Afghanistan. But then I think one of our challenges is to encourage, to incentivize local groups to use that and to sort of upload their own material to that central source, which is public to the extent that the sources are public, can be confidential to the extent that we or the source of information wants it to be confidential. Part of this is still to be tested. It's this new software we're using. We are told we have the capacity to do that. We haven't explored and tested it yet. But that I think, in our view, sort of the approach to lessening fragmentation is sort of balanced by how much we can encourage and incentivize local groups to use this same platform to share the material. And that remains to be seen.
But that's a good, I mean, that's probably the best in a sort of a horizontal space, probably the best way to encourage coordination to provide public goods, right? You know, that's, and if somebody's willing to fund the provision of the public goods and someone else is willing to be the administrator of the public good, both of which are, by definition, the public goods, right? They're not selfish things. Then I suppose that's the best way forward. I honestly think we could have done a better job, can still do a better job at DCCAM being sort of a public goods provider in that vein. And so looking forward, it's something that we need to improve. If we're going to be the long-term host for this archive, we need to make it more accessible for other groups' projects to sort of feed into that and to give them something in return, which is access to web platforms and other things that they might
want. Do you have access to, is there public access to part of the archive at DCCAM, or is the access really controlled still by DCCAM vis-a-vis the tribunal or whoever, you know, individual researchers? I mean, is there a public, I should know the answer to this question, but I don't. Is there a public access?
It's telling that you don't know it because it's sort of deliberately, you know, let's say informal in quotes, in the sense that it, the letter of the access rules that we wrote is that these are public materials, but the director reserves the right to grant approvals to it the way that you would to, say, a U.S. presidential archive, which means that in practice there's a screening mechanism, and that screening mechanism creates some space to sort of manage the volume of and the identities of the people coming in. There are a couple times early in the center's history where relatives of Khmer Rouge leaders wanted to get access to the archive and just too risky, right? So in rare instances, the directors had to say no. In other instances, the people who are coming for access are people who have explicit interests in the proceedings, like prosecution or defense.
Right.
So they have to be sort of somebody in the room from the documentation center handing them documents and sitting there next to them while they use it. And then in other cases, it's researchers who, after a few times, establish a relationship with the center and are trusted and therefore can be given the same sort of reading room rights that you would get if you went to a U.S. archive. Mm-hmm.
So, but you have something online. I remember from, you know, several years ago that you have stored, I mean, you
yes,
know.
Yes, some of the documents, a subset, are online, yeah. That's true. And what we're trying to do now is to digitize them, because now that the tribunal is passing, we'd like to do something very similar to the Benson Collection at Texas, which is is done with Guatemalan documents, which is to put large numbers of them up digitally and to make them searchable and accessible to anybody who wants to look at them. Because as time has gone by, the political, you know, the temperature has come down in the country. There's less of a fear of retribution and so forth, and there's less of a problem contaminating legal proceedings since those are wrapping up. When the tribunal ends, we want to have this digitized version of all of the collection go public and be visible.
Aren't they now digitized, or they're mostly microfilm?
Mostly microfilm, and we're working on digitizing them. It's a problem, back to this question of sort of, you know, whose property are they and who's funding it and so forth. It's been a long process. But the ideal from our standpoint would be maximum information disclosure. We have to think through and still haven't resolved how we'll deal with, we're no longer concerned with anything pertaining to sort of security redactions, but we are still concerned about privacy-related redactions. since a lot of the confession transcripts have information about people who are still alive. Mm-hmm. So we have to work through that before we put them on.
Right. And so what subset of documents would you say is criteria for deciding that could be public?
I think the criteria was to give sort of an illustrative example, similar to what maybe the Archives of Terror from Paraguay have done with UNESCO, mm-hmm. to put like emblematic documents mm-hmm. on that demonstrate the some of the documents that give a flavor for the policies of the regime, mm-hmm. but I wasn't involved in selecting the documents, so I don't know the exact process they went through mechanically. Uh-huh. I know that what they were aiming to do is to just have a small number that would be affordable given their funding that uh-huh. could be put online as an illustration of everything that's available.
Right.
And I don't believe that those documents were that any of them were redacted for privacy purposes, so I'm sure that was a consideration before uh-huh. they were put online.
So, you know, redaction issues on the ones that were...
At least the people at Yale who were making decisions in DC CAN, Yale posted mm-hmm. them on their website. Those folks who I wasn't involved in that particular part of our work, mm-hmm. They evidently decided that the ethical issues were all clear.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to be sure if we do the whole collection that we go through a fresh round of review.
Well, we're nearing the end of our time. We're almost at 4:00. I wanted to again kick it back to Christian and TK to see if they had any final thoughts that they would like to share, and kind of do that for everybody at the table before we wrap up. Christian.
Yeah, I really liked hearing about the this idea of the public service that's the ability to provide a public good. And that's really, I think, something that we're aiming for. And one of the technical barriers that we have is that we, that we want to be able to provide a platform that anybody can use, and they can make things public if they want, they can keep things private if they want, but they are somehow preserved and broadly accessible should that be a goal. And we just haven't been able to find the right platform to be able to do that. And that's, that would be something that we would love to do, is find that platform and host it and have that responsibility for making sure it's used appropriately. I think that our partners would really benefit from such a thing. You know, there was some talk about competition and the collaboration, and a public good like that would allow both. You know, organizations could collaborate, but if they wanted to compete, it would be a place for organizations to make themselves, increase their awareness and their relevance to both national and international communities, and help them to attract funding for their own programs, for collaborative programs. I just think that idea of a public good really has a lot of possibility.
If ever what we do is of interest, our software is for share. We are more than willing to give our database and even explain to people why and how we are putting these stories out, and we will be happy to share our experience and the results so that people get encouraged to put some of these things out for the international community to view too.
We would say the same. I don't know if you're thinking, Christian, of sort of one site, much like yours, I think, where you have links to the different projects that you have assisted over over time, where, you know, somebody could come in and instead of being present at our conversation, themselves kind of go through the different, you know, sort of links to the different documentation projects and their work. Maybe you're thinking of something more sophisticated than that, but that may be a start. Maybe there's a way that we could, you know, link to, or that UT could link to each of our projects, not so much because, you know, not because you're providing technical or even funding assistance to us, but because of our collaborative work in trying to draw some lessons learned across projects.
So I have just one quick thought, and that is that we've mentioned funding a number of times in the conversation. I think in addition to this sort of cross-country collaborations being useful for learning from each other how to best do the documentation work, I also have a sense of optimism about what this could do for the relationship of all of our efforts to the people who fund them, which is to say that someone who worked on Guatemala now understands, hey, this stuff is really important, and now I'm working on another country, maybe I'm working on Burma, and I take to me with Burma, you know, that experience of understanding the importance, because they are an audience just like the audiences, just like we are an audience, just like the survivors of human rights abuses are an audience, who sort of needs to appreciate the importance and the sort of deferred payoff potential of these, putting these structures in place. So I hope if we, are, you know, if we stay in touch, that we can work on that issue as well. Donors as an audience.
Yeah, it's a great idea. TK, back to you, and just to give you the floor for a minute, did you have any final thoughts?
I have to. Oh, go ahead. It's been really instructive being able to learn from all the different challenges that you folks have come across and the types of documentation work that you've been doing. And it really does illustrate how these documentation efforts face similar challenges, and particularly technical ones. So I think John's suggestion of thinking about how such a collaboration could be fundable to address some of these technical issues would definitely be something that we'd be interested in and working towards.
Patty?
Just that, two things, I guess. One is I also really like this idea of thinking in terms of it as a public resource, and I think that is something in terms of conversations with the Afghan groups that would make sense in terms of appealing to them as seeing that as a value for them, as also, you know, more generally a value for Afghan society to have such a resource, and may make the kind of idea of contributing to a database more interesting and important. And also, I think for me, just hearing all this, I realize, you know, obviously that the problems Afghanistan is dealing with, their Afghan groups are not unique, which is always useful to be reminded of that. So that's been very helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. I think there's an appetite to continue the conversation, which I share. I know that we're sort of all over the place at this point, but I'm happy to continue to use, you know, this technology to continue to convene us. I propose maybe a follow-on with a focus on maybe how to understand this as a public good and how to communicate the value and the importance of the documentation efforts to funders, linking to your last suggestion, as sort of the topic of our next conversation. And I'm thinking probably fall, maybe. It would maybe nice, Patty, you're thinking your trip to Afghanistan will be in September, correct?
That's what I'm thinking now, yeah.
Would this be useful for you before or after that?
Well, because there are going to be two trips. I think it would be good to have it maybe after that trip before the second trip would probably be ideal, if that's possible.
Yeah, okay. So how about late September? Would that I know you don't have dates set yet, but does that sound relatively reasonable?
Either that or early October.
Early October? Okay. Does that sound like a possibility? You know, again, you don't have to be physically present.
Oh, yeah,
we can pipe
sure.
you in. But Christian and TK, early October seem like a possibility for you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That works on this end.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, then we will follow up both with the sort of notes from this conversation, as well as sort of nailing down a time in early October for the follow-on conversation. But in the meantime, please feel free. We now have everybody's email to send us the ICTJ Lessons Learned report. I will send around the blog post from SJAC. I'll include them in this conversation in terms of summarizing what happened here or giving them the podcast of this conversation. But feel free, to not stop the conversation artificially now and then just pick it up in October, but to continue it online to the extent that ideas come forward.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.